The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Coming to a food truck near you? Well, I'm betting on the food of the Philippines. You see, the stars are aligned. We love the undiscovered. We love all things Asian Pacific and intriguingly spiced. And we're relatively clueless about Filipino cooking. So look for dishes like adobo.
Adobo involves the cooking of, you know, any meat, seafood, fruit, or vegetable in a mixture of vinegar, bay leaves, black pepper, garlic, and salt or soy sauce. Every household has their different version of adobo. That's why it's such a comfort food for many Filipinos.
That's Marvin Gapultos. He's creator of LA's first Filipino food truck. Well, today we talk the food of the Philippines, all 7,000 islands worth. Stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Like any self-respecting little kid, Marvin Gapultos condescended to eat a few things his mother cooked and boycotted the rest, loudly. He wanted American food, you know, pizza and burritos, not his mom's adobo and sinigang. Well, Marvin grew up Filipino. Now, talk about a sleeper. We know next to nothing about Filipino food. Imagine the riot of different tastes that you get from a country of 7,000 islands and who knows how many foreign overlays. Well, Marvin came around to his mom's food. In fact, he brought LA its first Filipino food truck, the Manila Machine. He's now written the Adobo Road Cookbook, a Filipino food journey from food blog to food truck and beyond. Marvin, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote in the book that the Philippines are, I was surprised by this, 7,000 islands?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, I'm sure there's more than that, but yeah, the rough number is 7,000 islands.
Okay, so if you've got 7,000 islands and you've got a lot of different foreign influences, is there a typical Philippine taste or is it just incredibly diverse?
Well, Filipino cuisine is incredibly diverse. I mean, that's one of the great things about it. But maybe the most pervasive flavor, I guess, of Filipino food would be sourness, just because we like to cook with vinegar and with, you know, different citrus juices.
One of the national dishes, or maybe the national dish, is adobo, right?
Right.
And adobo is anything, if I got this right, cooked in soy sauce and vinegar.
Right. Adobo pretty much is a cooking method more than it is a dish. I mean, yes, it's the name of a dish, but it's really a cooking method. And that particular method involves the cooking of, you know, any meat, seafood, fruit, or vegetable in a mixture of vinegar, bay leaves, black pepper, garlic, and salt or soy sauce, depending, you know, on which you like. You know, soy sauce was introduced by the Chinese long after we were making adobo. So the earliest adobos were made with sea salt.
And you use really interesting vinegars, right?
Yeah. The Philippines has so many great artisanal vinegars. You know, some are made from coconut. Some are made from palm sap and sugar cane. So they're really, generally speaking, each vinegar could be used in place of the other. But they do each have their little different nuanced tastes and flavors.
Tell me, how did you learn to cook?
Honestly, I didn't learn to cook until much later in life. I mean, I was around Filipino food all the time, but I never really took an interest in cooking it until, you know, after I moved away from home, after college, and after I got married, you know, because my wife isn't Filipino. So one day I just had a craving for adobo, and I didn't know how to make it. My wife obviously didn't know how to make it, so That was kind of like a turning point for me, and where I decided I needed to learn, you know, at the very least, my family's recipes. And so, you know, I just started asking my mom lots of questions and my grandmother and my grandmother's sisters. So I just kind of went from there.
Then you eventually ended up with the first food truck in L.A. that was doing Filipino food. So how did that come about?
Well, it was actually a very terrifying leap. I had no previous restaurant experience. I had no previous, you know, professional cooking experience whatsoever. You know, I just had the recipes on my blog, and I knew I wanted to share Filipino food, and I knew I had to do something beyond my blog to do that. And at the time, you know, food trucks were the big thing, and it just got into my body that I had to open a food truck and cook Filipino food. And it was terrifying because I had no idea what I was doing. But it ended up being pretty good.
What foods were you doing?
I served a pork belly and pineapple adobo. We also served some Filipino sliders, which had different Filipino meats stuffed into these little Filipino sweet rolls called pandesal. And I also served a sisig, which is a bar snack in the Philippines, which consists of pork jowls and ears and nose. And that was actually a really popular dish, which was kind of surprising.
Uh-huh.
It was really great just to see how open people were.
Well, talking about this, are there dishes that are considered, you know, the mom and apple pie dishes of the Philippines, kind of the calling cards to the world?
Definitely adobo would be one of them.
Right.
Just because it's so pervasive and so loved in the Philippines. And every household has their different version of adobo. And so that's why it's such a comfort food for many Filipinos. And sinigang is another dish. It's a Filipino sour soup. You could pretty much put anything in a sinigang, fish or beef or chicken. And it, depending on the region, it's soured with either citrus juice or green tamarind, or even sometimes guava or sour pineapples even.
Wow. One other dish?
A particular dish I like, and I always have when I go back home to my mom's house or to my grandmother's, is pinakbet, which is a Filipino vegetable stew that some people say it's similar to a ratatouille in that it has tomatoes and eggplant and different squashes, and it also has bitter melon in it. And bitter melon is an acquired taste, but it's one of the great things about that dish because it has every flavor of the palate. You have the bitterness from the bitter melon, you know, sweetness and tang from tomatoes, and then you have saltiness and umami from fish sauce.
Marvin, thanks so much. We now have at least an introduction to Philippine food.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Marvin Gapultos has written the Adobo Road Cookbook. Now, you've got to try his salmon and miso sour soup. The recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out the latest project, a quarterly ebook, Eating In with Lynn, Weekend Menus and Worknight Encores. It's my quarterly diary of what's happening in my kitchen on weekends, with lots of extras, from cooking lessons and shortcuts to my latest finds and opinions. Everything, everything is at splendidtable.org. There's a man in New York City who is conjuring what we can taste in great restaurants across the country. Now, the chefs in those kitchens speak of him as though he's an oracle, a magician. They say his work elevates everything they cook, and yet they can't figure out how he does it. Lior Lev Circaz creates spice blends, elusive and evocative blends done by some insight and instinct. Now, he knows cooking. He was a chef for the French master Daniel Boulou, but he left that kitchen to open his own spice shop, Le Boîte à Épices, or The Spice Box, in New York City. And that's where he talked with food writer J.J. Good.
Hi, Lior. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, J.J. Good to be here.
So tell me a little about your background.
Well, I'm from Israel originally. I've been away for the last 14 or 15 years. I was born in a kibbutz in Galilee and started cooking fairly early, you know, when I was 10, 11. Not because my mother was a phenomenal chef or a restaurant owner, it's just because she was working late. So I had to prepare dinner. I got really into cooking at the age of 18 or 19 when I joined the military. So I was a sergeant, so I was in charge of the cooks. And then later on, I started cooking in a catering company. From there, I moved to France, went to the Paul Bocuse Institute, a very
fancy,
famous cooking school in Lyon, and stayed working three additional years in France, and moved to New York in 2002 to work for Daniel Boulou.
The legend, the man
the
himself.
The legendary, yeah. I stayed with him for about 4.5 years, and until I decided to follow my own career and do what I do now, which is biscuits or cookies and spices.
And now how did you get into spices? I mean, there's so many things you could have done. You could have done pickles.
Mustards,
like everybody,
oils.
Yeah. Why spices?
I think spices have to do a lot with my background, again, being from Israel and eating food with a lot of spices in it. And again, the big difference between spicy and hot. You could use spices, yet it doesn't mean that it's hot. Heat is a whole other element. And then really, I've noticed a very big lack of knowledge from my colleagues, you know, as chefs, not knowing about a lot of spices. I think the biggest change in my career was while I was living in France. In one of my jobs, I was working in Brittany, in the north of France, and I worked for a very renowned, famous chef called Olivier Rollinger. And he was very well known, still is, for his usage of spices. He travels a couple of times a year to India and Indonesia to really source a lot of spices. And going from an average French kitchen with about 10, 15 spices on the spice rack, you go to about 120. So that
wow.
was a
wow.
yeah, big change. And I was
So his
really,
pantry had about 120.
Oh, yeah, about 120. And
I couldn't even name 40 spices, I don't think.
Yeah, it's hard. But I was just blown away. And I was very curious. And he was very smart about it. He forced me to go back home and do my own research. And I just became really excited and passionate about spices. And spices were a way for me to express myself, you know. I enjoy the sourcing, so meeting farmers or growers in countries.
So here's what might be a silly question.
Sure.
Where do spices come from? I mean, I kind of have, in my head, I imagine they come from a factory in New Jersey or the supermarket.
They're pretty. That's what I usually tell people, that they don't grow in Ohio or in Idaho in a factory. They come from fields all over the world. They're obviously regions that are a bit bigger in growing spices, like Asia. So India, Indonesia, Vietnam. Then there's Turkey, a little bit Eastern Europe. So it's important to understand that they come from a field somewhere. And in most cases, the terrain is very rough. So there's a lot of manual labor, not a lot of mechanical equipment that can go. So, and people still own very small parcels. So they will grow a few pounds or a few hundred pounds. And then from that moment on, they will travel to the local kind of broker, if you will, until we get them here in the U.S. There's a long way before we get them here. So sourcing both for the professional but also for the home cooks, how do you know
right.
if a spice is good? How do you know where it came from? It's
right.
very hard when you pick up a jar in your local supermarket. I think the easiest way is just to, you know, look at them and see their color. You know, if there's a lot of pieces of dust in them and they're broken, something's already wrong, you know. And then you can teach yourself very easily, you know, if something has good flavor, if it smells good, then it's probably a good ingredient. And I would buy smaller quantities to start with, just to get an idea if your source is good or not. And I always tell people that it's a waste of time to buy good meat, fish and vegetables and season them poorly with bad salt or bad pepper.
Right.
So if you could spend a little bit of time educating yourself of what do you like? Do you prefer black pepper to white, to green, to pink? Do you prefer sea salt to mine salt to iodized salt? There's no right or wrong. It's what's good for you.
Right. And so once you have these great spices, why not just sell these beautiful spices? So why? Because you sell
blends.
These amazing blends.
Correct. So I chose blending because I wanted to allow people to have one jar of a great blend versus having seven jars that they never use in
right.
their pantry. And I live in a very small apartment
right.
Where every inch matters in the pantry. So I think that's a great tip for people who like to cook yet are, you know, don't have much space or much time. So that's where I can help them. What I also help them is to discover that even if they think that they don't like a certain cuisine, they don't really know what they're talking about. They actually do. They just had a bad experience in the, you know. And I also try to explain to them that there's no need to become something that you're not. You're not going to become an Indian cook or a Pakistani or Turkish, because that takes years. But you could give your everyday dishes that you're familiar with a little note from those countries. One of my funniest clients, who doesn't even cook, she just orders in and just adds the blend to whatever she orders. So she can order 5 days in a row white rice But one day it tastes Moroccan, then the next day it tastes Southeast Asian, and so on and so forth. And she enjoys it for, I think it's fantastic. You know, I always say it's traveling without going anywhere.
That's amazing.
You can stay home and travel.
Right.
So that's why blending. I think it also tells stories of different cultures and different eating habits. And it makes just cooking fun. It takes it from the 2D to the 3D dimension.
Interesting. Lior, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here today.
Lior Lev-Sercaz's New York City spice shop is La Boite à Épices, or The Spice Box. Now, he was talking with food writer J.J. Good, who is co-author of chef Aaron Sanchez's book, Simple Food, Big Flavor. Lior shared a recipe from one of his friends, Apollonia Poilin, of Poilin, the famous Parisian bakery. Now, it uses the blend that he created especially for her of spices, cocoa, and orange blossom. Can you believe? Now, you can find lamb meatballs with spinach salad at splendidtable.org. Coming up, where the next great reds may come from. We talk the wines of Argentina. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Daniel Klein and videographer Mira Fine created the perennialplate.com. Now, these two crisscross the planet to learn how people really eat and create their foods in their home countries. They've been to the rice terraces of China, met the goats of Louisville, and found the seed savers of India. Well, they're joining us from the BBC in London. Mira, Daniel, it is so good to be talking to you again. So what's the latest?
It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, we just got back from Spain and the Basque Country. And the Basque Country is this autonomous area in Spain, has one of the oldest languages in the world. They sometimes blow up bombs to try to gain their independence. But culinary food is the most important thing in their culture, along with their language and their land.
There are some pretty famous cheeses coming out of the Basque Country. It sits between Spain and France. And
yes.
I understand you got to a particular cheesemaker.
Yeah. You know, Idiazabal cheese is actually known for coming from the Basque region. And it's also known for coming from a specific type of sheep, which is called the Lacha sheep. Those are like the beautiful sheep with the long hair. And we found this man whose name was Urtzi, and he was a newer sheep herder. You know, most sheep herders have been doing it for generations.
Right.
It's actually one of the oldest professions in the world. But similar to American farmers, these days, most of the Basque sheep herders are above 60 years old, so it's at a risk of eventually disappearing. So the interesting thing about Urtzi is that he didn't come from a sheep herding family or a farming family. He actually just decided that he wanted to be a sheep herder because he actually trained sheepdogs.
It was really cool to show off his skills. He actually herded chickens for us.
Oh, that's so cute.
Imagine this cute little shepherd dog running around in this apple orchard, you know.
Just by him whistling or making little noises, the dog would run around. It was really, really cool.
And so here's this setting of beautiful green grass and these stone mountains hanging over us. And
these beautiful rolling hills.
I think there may
sheep.
Have even been a double rainbow.
There was a double rainbow.
Oh, my.
But the other interesting thing is that, you know, traditionally farmers used to make Idiazabal cheese by hand. And lately, large companies have been buying sheep milk at very low prices and making really mass-produced Idiazabal cheese. So it's harder for these smaller farmers who are trying to do it the handmade, artisanal way, and that's what Urtzi is trying to do.
Uh-huh.
There's this real farmstead cheese, which is when the herder also makes his own cheese. So this is a small flock of sheep that they milk in the morning and the evening and then make the cheese the next morning after it's cooled.
Which is how it was traditionally done up in the Pyrenees Mountains. These sheep herders would stay up there throughout the spring and summer and then keep their wheels of cheese next to the chimneys of their mountain house. And there they would age and they would also get smoked.
And so what does the cheese actually taste like?
We were talking about this before we got here. Like, how can we describe it?
Yeah.
I think sheep's milk cheese is always a little sweeter. Mira disagreed with me a little bit.
I think they're a little bit more buttery. I mean, there's definitely something really special about sheep's milk cheeses. You know, Idiazabal to me is very, it's very buttery and nutty and has like a slightly smoky flavor sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't. Ortsy's cheese, the one that we tried, was actually not smoked.
And you can compare it to a Manchego. I think I like it a little bit better, but they have a similar quality to them. But you can get them, you know, you can have this young sheep's milk cheese that is a little lighter, and then you can age it several years, and it starts to get a little bit dry mm-hmm. and a lot salty. And, you know, that you can see almost like, you know, shaving it on top of something instead of eating a big
right,
piece of it.
Right. He hasn't picked an easy profession. I mean, a sheep herder, you're talking about literally herding sheep over miles and miles. You're outdoors constantly. You're a caretaker. What a profession.
Yeah, I mean, it is a hard profession, and he did tell us that it wasn't easy, and he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to do it forever. But it's also his love for animals is why he does it. You know, he said the relationship between the sheep herder and the dog is extremely important, you know, a relationship of respect and trust. And also with his sheep, you know, it's something that he cares for them, and they in turn give something back to him. And he was saying there's people in the area who care for animals as though they're kind of like cars, like they treat them as objects. And that's not how animals should be cared for. It was very sweet.
But yeah, you treat the animal well, it gives you the milk, and it's like this, yeah, this beautiful exchange. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's a hard profession, not only with being outside and the constant work, but also pretty much everyone we talked to in Spain talked about the financial situation there and the difficulty in getting jobs and now, you know, selling expensive cheese. You know, this is a special product. It's not the block of orange cheddar that you yeah. put on your sandwich or whatever. This is something that's really, really fine and does cost a little bit of money. So in the financial situation there, he's invested a lot of time, a lot of money, and, you know, is struggling to make ends meet. And we've talked to several producers of different things in the area, and everyone had this strong desire to keep these really beautiful traditions alive. So I hope that he continues, and I know that within the Basque Country that these beautiful examples of cheese and other things will stay alive.
Let's wish him the best of luck. Fascinating story. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Daniel Klein and Mira Fine have the perennialplate.com, and they were just awarded a James Beard Award for the best video webcast on location. Now, for more on their travels, head to the website splendidtable.org. That cheese the shepherd was making, Idiazabal, well, that's a local tradition in the Basque Country that's protected by EU law. The milk has to come from only Laxta or Carranza sheep breeds. The cheese is buttery and it can be lightly smoked. Quince jam is one of the traditional partners for it. I like it sliced, scattered with a few leaves of rosemary, and then zigzagged with a thread of olive oil and eaten with peaches or pears. Wines of Argentina have been on a tear over the last decade. They're on a lot of experts' short lists for good drinking for little money. But two things come to mind here. One is, other than looking for the word Argentina on the label, we really don't know much about these wines. And two, I hear Argentina is poised to take on the big boys of great reds. Our guest, Laura Catena, is a fourth-generation Argentinian winemaker. Her father, Nicholas, is famous for his winemaking and his Catena Zapata vineyard. And she's famous for her Lucas vineyard. Laura's written Vino Argentino, an insider's guide to the wines and wine country of Argentina. Laura, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Lynn.
As I said, we know so little about the wines of Argentina. We drink them, but we're kind of clueless as to where they come from, what their characteristics are. And in this book, you do a tour. So could you give us a short tour?
Yes. Well, I wish that everybody who's listening to this show will come down and visit us in Argentina. It's actually not that far. It's from some places in the U.S., it's only a 10-hour flight. And most of the vineyards go from north to south of Argentina, and they are next to the Andes. And the distance is about 1,200 miles from the northernmost vineyards to the southernmost vineyards. From the north, there's Salta. Then you come to La Rioja, San Juan, Mendoza, where I'm from and where most of the wines come from. And then you get to Patagonia, Rio Negro, Neuquén. And if you can start dreaming, you know, imagine driving from north to south. That's already a trip in itself.
Right, right.
And it's just beautiful, great weather, very friendly people, and excellent food with a lot of meat.
Well, the kinds of grapes and the kinds of wines, what's the variety?
Well, the variety that's most famous for Argentina is called Malbec, and it's originally a French grape that was very famous in France in the Middle Ages in the 19th century, then brought to Argentina in 1852. And now there is Malbec grown from north to south, but possibly the most famous Malbec is the Malbec from Mendoza. Then you also have a white variety that's called Torrontés that grows in Salta. That's very aromatic, a beautiful wine. I have a recipe for Torrontés ice cream in my book that I highly recommend. But we also have a beautiful Cabernet Sauvignon, Syrah, even Pinot Noir, you know, and many, many more varieties. But I would say that the two most famous varieties are Malbec and Chardonnay. And Torrontés, and actually I just said Chardonnay. Actually, Chardonnay is very beautiful from Argentina because it's grown at high altitude. And so it has a very mineral touch. So I would say Malbec and Torrontés are the most sort of unique varieties to Argentina, but we also grow some of the other famous varieties.
So Malbec, what does a Malbec taste like?
Well, for me, and perhaps I'm biased, Malbec is the perfect wine because it has very intense aromatics, black fruits, a little spiciness, a very rich palate. It's actually one of the darkest wines and the richest wine. So it's very concentrated, yet it's very smooth on the palate. And that's a characteristic of the actual variety, that the smoothness, even if it has a lot of tannins, it's smooth.
Uh-huh. And the Torrontés.
So Torrontés is very aromatic. It almost makes you think of a Riesling, of a Gewürztraminer.
That spicy, sort of fruity quality?
Yes, yes. A floral, very floral. And then on the palate, it can be made dry or sweet. I actually prefer it when it's dry, and it has a sort of mineralness on the palate. It's a very light wine. It's a wine that you drink almost like you drink champagne, very sort of freely in the afternoon maybe or before dinner.
Sounds like a wonderful summer wine.
Yes, a wonderful summer one.
And well, you mentioned that the altitude affected the Chardonnay wine. What does altitude do for wine, high altitude?
So what high altitude does is it allows the plant to grow very slowly, but in a very sort of ideal environment, because you have a lot of sunlight and the plant needs the sunlight for the photosynthesis, for the leaves to bring in the energy to give the juice and the tannins to the grapes. But then it's quite cool there, and that allows the plant to rest at night and not to use up its acids and to mature slowly. So you're able to keep the grapes on the vine for a very long time under very good conditions. And also what happens is that the sugars don't go up too much. And, you know, none of us like those really alcoholic wines because basically, you know, wine is fermented sugar. So a wine that has a lot of sugar will have a lot of alcohol.
Right.
So in summary, what you get from the altitude is very nice aromatics, very crisp wines with nice acidity and a moderate alcohol level, not too high, that are very drinkable.
Laura, I understand that Malbec is making a bid for being one of the great reds. What's bringing that about? And is the wine being made differently than it was in the past?
Well, that's a very good question. In fact, I think a lot of the more serious nature of Malbec today has to do with the altitude that gives us wines with better acidity, with more tannins that can age better, and, you know, just more interesting wines. So I think Malbec is definitely a contender of the level of Cabernet Sauvignon, Syrah, Merlot, Chardonnay. And, you know, if you look back at the history of Malbec, you know, it was drank at the wedding of Helena of Aquitaine to Henry II. So it's a very famous wine historically. And I think that there's a reason for that. And today it's famous for Argentina, and it really is claiming a place in the world of important wine varieties. And I'm very happy about that, very proud of that.
You're saying it was served back in the 1500s in France and in England. Fascinating.
Yes, yes. Malbec was very famous back then. It was called the black wine because it's so dark. And it was also famous in Bordeaux in the 19th century. So it's a variety with a lot of history. And I always find that wine and history come together. And for me, that's very exciting that this variety, you know, first it's famous in the old world and now it's famous in the new world.
Intriguing. Laura, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Gracias.
Winemaker Laura Catena is author of Vino Argentino, an insider's guide to the wines and wine country of Argentina. Now, she makes wine, but she also loves to cook. Find Laura's recipe for ribeye steak with chimichurri and Patagonian potatoes on the website, splendidtable.org. You never call my name. Okay, let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And of course, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's see. We've got Lauren calling from Nashville. Lauren, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I made my first attempt at baking some cinnamon rolls last week.
Yeah.
And I seem to have an issue with the texture of my cinnamon sugar. Instead of getting that nice kind of like warm, gooey, sticky, I'm kind of getting stuck in your teeth sticky.
It's just gotten a little too hot, I think.
Okay. That's,
yeah, because what happens is it's really the cinnamon, you know, is the flavoring. But sugar, as it heats up, goes through all these different stages. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing. Explain to me, is the sugar, cinnamon sugar, going on top of the roll, or is it going just inside the roll?
It's just inside. So after you've rolled the dough out, it's kind of just, you know, pack it on.
Right. You roll out the dough into a big rectangle, you mm-hmm. sprinkle with the cinnamon sugar, and then you roll it up like a jelly roll, and you cut mm-hmm. it, and you make individual whatevers, right? Mm-hmm. And you're saying it's getting sticky. You might want to start using less cinnamon sugar.
Oh,
a bit
okay.
less, yeah. Because I think there just may be a tad too much in there. The other thing is, do you dot it with butter as well?
You know, it wasn't so much that I dotted it with butter. The recipe called for 12 tablespoons of butter.
Yeah, but makes a difference.
Yeah. So essentially I ended up kind of melting it to a spreading consistency and then kind of brushed it on. Is there a better technique for
I
that?
I think if they say to dot it on, dot it on. It's going to change a little bit the consistency of the sugar, but mainly it may be cutting back a bit on the sugar.
Okay.
What temperature are you baking it at, by the way?
Let's see. It calls for 350. And so far, the oven that I'm using right now is pretty spot on with the temperature. So I want to say probably about 350, 375.
Okay. Yeah, because if you go too hot, you're going to also get that reaction.
Okay.
And, you know, get an oven thermometer, though, just to be on the safe side.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. We will be back to take more of your questions in a minute and examine the big question, to salt or not to salt. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, it is back to your questions. Let's connect. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252 is one way to get to us. Go to the website, send an email, splendidtable.org, or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Greg is calling from Portland, Oregon. So, Greg, what do you want to talk about?
Well, today I'd like to talk about spices, if you're okay with that.
I'd love to talk about spices.
Okay. Well, we've got a large spice drawer that we've kind of acquired a lot of different spices from our travels and from the store. And I was just going through and organizing it the other day, and there were five spices that I'm not even sure we've ever used. And I thought I'd run them past you and see if you could suggest what they might be good for.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
All right.
Here's the five. Chervil, lovage, marjoram, fenugreek seeds, and sumac.
Ooh, okay. Now, except for the fenugreek seeds, depending on how old the others are, because they're leaf herbs, more or less, because sumac is more of like a pistil, if I remember, of a flower. But anyway, the point is they fade. They can fade after about 3 months.
That was my other question, how long they're good for.
You know, I learned a lesson because I grabbed some cinnamon, you know, out of the – I buy it by the bag sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed it and I threw it into a cookie recipe and I made the cookies and the cinnamon flavor was really important and it didn't have any cinnamon flavor because I hadn't sniffed and I hadn't put the date on the bag. Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. Chevrel is really, really delicate. It's I think, part of the carrot family, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And it's very subtle and it has a very it's hard to describe. A very green, faintly carroty quality. It's not sweet, but more delicate.
Okay.
And it's used a lot in Belgian cooking, believe it or not. And it is an herb that is easy to grow. It's just about as easy as something like parsley. And it's kind of lovely with delicate dishes like fish and creamy dishes.
Okay.
The dried stuff doesn't have a lot of taste.
Oh, so fresh is better, huh?
Fresh is better, yeah. Okay. And you don't buy it. You got to grow it. You just never see it.
Okay.
Now, marjoram is a cousin of oregano, but it's sort of sweeter. And it's actually sometimes referred to as sweet marjoram.
Yeah, and it has a sweet smell.
Right. And you want a dried whole leaf. And again, sniff it and smell it. If you don't get a lot of really sweet, think of basil crossed with oregano.
Oh.
That's what marjoram reminds me of.
Mm-hmm.
And marjoram you use with all kinds of things. It goes with almost any meat, but especially lamb and poultry and pork. It's used a lot in Italian food. It's used a great deal in French food. I think Spain uses it as well. But what I like to do is I like to mix it with a little bit of olive oil and some shallots. You know, something that's gently garlicky, but more marjoram than anything else.
Okay.
And then I make slits in something like, you know, a piece of beef or chicken breasts or whatever, and then really slow cook them in a pan or on the grill, brushing them with olive oil. Now, tell me, what was the other one?
Lovage.
Okay. Lovage, I've got to think about that.
Okay,
I haven't tasted it in a while. It's, again, a leaf herb, rather delicate. If I remember correctly, it has an almost celery-like quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never used it dry. I've always used it fresh, which meant I had to grow it.
Yeah.
But I would say take a sniff of it and take a taste of it. Whenever you're in doubt about whether or not flavors are going to work together, you know, spices, herbs, take a little bit of each one on your tongue. And see what happens. And that'll tell you right away whether or not it's going to work. Now, sumac is a lemony, really delicious. It's used a lot in the Middle East.
Yeah, this one I know we brought back home from Turkey.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, going to the source. Now, it should smell quite lemony.
Okay.
If it's too old, it won't. But you can order that. I mean, you can find that in spice shops and whatever. But it should smell quite lemony, and it's usually not cooked into things. It's sprinkled on top. Like, for instance, you have a bowl of really good yogurt.
Okay.
Take some black pepper, sprinkle that on, make a little pool of olive oil in it, and then sprinkle on that sumac. The color is magnificent. It's that dark brick red, and it's in threads, but it's fabulous. It is incredible on cooked lamb. It's wonderful on pita. It's great with olive oil on anything. Fish, anything. It's great. I love it, too, on eggplant. Take it, grill the eggplant slow, take it off, sprinkle on some chopped fresh mint. Not too much, but a nice, generous amount of the sumac.
Okay. And how about fenugreek seeds?
All right. Fenugreek seeds are used a lot in Indian cooking. They have a funky, I don't think they resemble fennel, really, but they're kind of a funky, herby flavor. There's no substitute for them. Generally, they're toasted first or fried and maybe then ground. Sometimes they're used whole. Potatoes and fenugreek are fabulous. Sweet potatoes and fenugreek are incredible. And any lamb dish, any beef dish, anything with yogurt. And just check out Indian recipes. Wonderful in just about, you know, anything. And believe it or not, with a slightly underripe mango, some crushed fenugreek, and some fresh lime, and a little chili, not a bad combination.
That sounds great.
So you're off and running, and if they're all kind of deader than doornails,
yeah,
you've got a great excuse to replace them.
So you think like a year is about the expiration date on those?
Leaf herbs, 3 months.
3 months.
Of prime,
okay.
Of being in their prime. But again, trust your nose.
Okay.
And then whole spices, like fenugreek, a year. Yeah. Okay. And sometimes, like peppercorns, a couple of years. Yeah.
Well, I'll be cleaning out our spice rack, I think.
By the way, with spices, it's just far better to buy them whole and grind them in a secondhand coffee grinder.
Okay.
Just because, first of all, they'll taste sensational, and secondly, they're going to last a long time.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks, Lynn.
Enjoy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, Greg. Paul is calling from Peterborough, Ontario. Paul, where's Peterborough?
It's halfway between Toronto and Ottawa in south central Ontario.
Ah, is it rural or is it more suburban?
It's a rural area. We live on a small farm and we grow a number of our own vegetables.
Oh, that sounds pretty great. What's your question, by the way?
Well, my wife, Allison, and I are adventurous cooks and gardeners, and we grow over 60 different types of fruits and vegetables as well.
Whoa.
As 2 dozen different herbs. And we have many wonderful uses for all the things that we grow, but we need your help with what to do with fresh chickpeas.
Oh, my. You know, the last time I got to work with a fresh chickpea, I think it was 20 years ago in California. Oh, my. Well, remind me. Okay. Are they as hard as rocks when they're fresh? I don't think
they are. No, they're not. They're a beautiful, delicate little fern-type plant, and they have little pods containing two
right.
little chickpeas each.
Right.
And they're plump, and they have a nice creamy texture, and they have a mild bean flavor, but they're a little bitter.
Well, I think, first of all, the bitterness may be, I don't know this for sure, but when there's an element of bitterness, especially in something that normally we find cooked in some way, or dried and ready to be cooked, and soaked and all that, there may be an element of toxicity there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I'd ask you to look up. But the other thing is, if there is any chance of that, lightly simmering them, because this is what I would do. If you've got fresh chickpeas, it would be just wonderful to just saute them with a little bit of olive oil and give them a bit of onion, maybe the smallest amount of fresh tomato when it comes in, and then just simmer them a little bit in the natural juices. So essentially, they're almost getting coated with those seasonings as they cook. And you give them maybe at most 5 or 10 minutes.
Sounds
and
nice.
Test
give
them
a
then.
Little squeeze of lemon too, maybe.
Yeah, but then taste them and see if that bitterness has decreased.
Sounds good.
Yeah, the other thing that would be wonderful to do with them is toss them with olive oil, whatever seasonings you want, and slow roast them, 300 degrees. You want to keep that delicate quality.
Just bring out a bit of a nutty flavor as well.
Yes, exactly. I think you've got a gem there. It's a delicacy most of us never get our hands
on. Something we very rarely see in the markets, and that's why we decided to grow them ourselves. And they're a beautiful little plant. We'd like to find a way to really showcase them.
Are they hard to grow?
Not too bad. I think because of our cooler climate, they may be a little smaller than they would be, but
mm-hmm.
We start them in the ground, and they make it through and produce little pods halfway through summer.
So are they? They're an annual, though.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah,
plant them every year.
You know, it's not quite. It could be not too late to give a shot at growing your own chickpeas.
Yeah, I think as soon as the last frost is over with, just plant them in the ground, and up they come.
Yeah, you know, there's also, by the way, I should mention, there's a wonderful soup where you saute. You cook the chickpeas in a bit of water. Now, this is done with dried chickpeas, but I think it'd be wonderful with the fresh. And what you do is puree half of them, put them back in that water, and it should be slightly sweet. And then saute garlic, onion, and fresh rosemary in olive oil. And just as you're putting the broth in bowls, you just spoonfuls of that saute that
Sounds
you stir
lovely.
In. And it's delicate, and it's fabulous. It's
Fantastic.
Just fabulous. Yeah. Love to hear more about your garden sometime, too.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Enjoy the show, and we'll see you soon.
Okay. Take care. 800-537-5252 is one way to reach us. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You know, we can't live without it. It's essential to our lives, yet it's constantly demonized. I'm talking about salt. Everything it touches gets a lift, including supposedly our blood pressure. Well, over and over we hear we eat too much salt. So exactly what are the rules? How much salt do you really get in that marinade or the salted pasta water? Managing producer Sally Swift talked with Sydney Fry. She's assistant editor of nutrition at Cooking Light magazine. Sally got some interesting details.
Hey, Sydney, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you for having me.
So I was raised with an Italian mother who insisted that the pasta water had to taste like the sea or there was not enough salt in it. How much of that salt really stays in that pasta?
You know, only about 3% of the salt is absorbed from the water into the pasta, but if that water really is salty as the seawater, that could end up being 800 to 900 milligrams of sodium, depending how much salt you're starting with.
And particularly if you're someone who holds back a little pasta water to moisten things up in the end, right?
Exactly.
Yep. What about when you brine something? Do you add more salt if you keep it longer in the brine, or is there a point when it just has absorbed all of the salt it's going to absorb?
I mean, I think the longer you brine it, it is going to continue to take up some amount of salt, but what we found, the majority of the salt is taken in the first 12 hours.
So you could actually limit some of the saltiness by brining it less than that?
Yes, you could. But we also found that the increase was far less significant the second 12 hours. So,
okay, what about canned beans, for instance, or canned vegetables? If you rinse them, can you remove any of the salt that's added to those cans?
We actually found a 40% reduction in sodium when we rinsed and drained canned beans. And I think the same would translate for vegetables, anything that is in a salty brine sort of solution. We found a 40% reduction when we rinsed and drained.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. That is significant. And I think will make a big difference. And canned beans are often added to soups and things that you're adding a lot more sodium to anyways.
What about measuring salt? For instance, when a recipe calls for a tablespoon of iodized salt, if you use a coarser salt, are you getting less sodium?
Conventional wisdom, actually, you would think that a coarser grind salt, there's less of it in a tablespoon than a finer grind because the crystals are bigger and there's actually less of them in the tablespoon. We actually found that it doesn't automatically yield sodium savings. And salt is salt. I mean, it's all sodium, basically, or it's all, you know, 40% sodium. And I think a lot of people think they're going to automatically make savings if they switch to kosher, and that's not always the case. You know, if you're watching your salt, you're going to need to watch it, whether it's sea salt, kosher salt, fine table salt.
There's just no way around it.
Yeah, it's all salt.
So, Sydney, do you have any overall advice for people who are watching salt?
I mean, I think one big part of it is to look at the labels on the food that you're eating. We actually ran a study with some soba noodles that the label says that they contained 400, 500, and 600 milligrams of sodium, but when they were boiled in the water, 80% of that sodium came out in the water while it was cooking.
So the sodium content is about what's actually in the package.
What's actually in, and mm-hmm. what you're actually going to consume. I mean, you can control a lot of the sodium you add to your food in your home, and it's always better to start with less. And last but not least, when you're eating out and you're eating processed foods, fast foods, that's where, when you're not in control, you never know how much sodium we're really getting. We looked at some numbers across the board of different types of food that had the same amount of sodium, and a milkshake has the same amount of sodium as a small container of French fries. And your taste buds often don't ever pick up on that.
That's very interesting. Sydney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Sydney Fry is assistant editor of nutrition at Cooking Light magazine. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great weekend. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Irena Chalmers, who said, "Salt is what makes things taste bad when it isn't in them." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to our website to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, download our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And take a look at our new quarterly e-book. It's called Eating In with Lynn, Weekend Menus, and Worknight Encores. Just head to the website, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.